We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
No Maria this morning. She's under the weather.
Yeah, but hopefully she'll be back next week.
Keeping our fingers crossed. Before we dive into this week's news, I wanted to note the passing of a local activist and close friend. Tom Lewiston died, we believe it was actually last weekend sometime. No one had heard from him for a couple days, and they eventually found him. He was integral in working with myself and others on Network X, the public access TV program that we produced for over a decade. And I had actually known of him through his work in the working on labor issues. I met him back in the late 80s when I worked at the Central America Peace Campaign, and his wife was on the board there. So a great local activist, major hole and major shoes to be filled there. So
yeah, condolences to you and to everybody else who knew him. And once again, somebody who will very much be missed.
Yeah. And so we all need to, another person gone, we need to step up and fill the void there.
We need a replacement.
Yes.
Yes.
So let's...
Applications are being taken online.
That's right. Just click on the icon on your screen.
Yes.
Let's start with local and Garfield teachers saying no.
Yeah, Garfield teachers setting a national precedent this week, actually. It is the first known time in the United States an entire school's faculty has refused to administer a test mandated by the district. In this case, it is the Measures of Achievement Progress test that is required by the Seattle School District. This is not the state test that has replaced WASL. It's a separate thing that the school district contracted with under former and late school superintendent Maria Goodloe Johnson. This is meant, it's not a graduation requirement. It is tied to teacher evaluations in the Seattle School District, and it's meant to give name says, a measure of where a student is in their academic progress, so that, you know, specialized lesson plans can be, you know, put together, blah, blah, blah. Well, the Garfield teachers are refusing to administer this in direct defiance of the Seattle School District leadership because of a number of reasons. And if you go through some of the things that they claim, it's it really does make one wonder exactly why the district is giving this thing, certainly at the high school level. The teachers, I should mention, are backed by the Dean of Testing at Garfield, as well as the Student Association and most of the staff. And their beef is specifically with MAP, not testing in general, the teacher evaluation tie in the union contract, or the new Washington State test. The complaints being that even the sample questions aren't available to the teachers, so they have no idea what the students are being tested on. But the questions apparently, through the, you know, the getting this from the students, are often very grade inappropriate and irrelevant to the lessons plans at Garfield, the curriculum of the school district, or for that matter, the state curriculum. The numbers show that disadvantages minority, immigrant, ESL, poor, and disabled kids. And of course, there's also the concern with that gender grade inappropriate questions can damage the self-esteem of kids. You know, I don't know this, I must be stupid, and that sort of thing, especially for at-risk kids. The teachers don't actually use the results that they get. The students don't even see them, and the students don't take it seriously because it's not tied to their grades or any kind of graduation requirements or any of that. So a number of them goof off on the test, but still, and you know, get terrible scores as a result, presumably. But that's still tied to teacher evaluations. So that's a problem. They have the Northwest Education Association, which is the people that put out the test, and that it sounds like a nice nonprofit group, but it actually is a for-profit corporation, as I understand it. Even their own guidelines say that students should be selected at random for this rather than it being given to, you know, all students in a given, class or a given grade, that it shouldn't be tied to teacher evaluations, and that, you know, for what Seattle School District wants to see as improvement for students, The test is given three times a year. So over the course of the year, the improvement is actually less than the margin of error for the test itself. So it's pretty random. And then, of course, there are complaints that it takes away from a great deal of class time. It ties up the computer labs at Garfield for weeks, and so on and so forth. And these are concerns that a number of other high school faculty have expressed as well, but Garfield is kind of taking the lead on this. Now, so why is Seattle School District doing this in the first place? Well, as it happens, the Northwest Education Association, Maria Goodloe Johnson, the former school superintendent, it turned out, had a great deal of money invested in the NWEA, both when the when it was originally adopted and then when the contract was renewed shortly afterwards in 2010. But it is up for renewal again next year, so hopefully this will put a little bit of a spotlight on why this test is being used in the schools. And, you know, sort of in general, the mind rush to testing, not so much that it's bad to have metrics for student progress in a school district, but it's bad to teach specifically to test and do nothing else. And it's bad to have testing for the sake of testing, which is that's a lot of what it sounds like as here. Now, in terms of the teachers at Garfield, it's going to be very interesting to see how the new superintendent and the school district respond. The only real precedent for this has to do with individual teachers. There were a handful that refused to give the WASL back when that was first introduced a few years ago. And those teachers were almost always suspended, but you obviously can't suspend an entire school's worth of faculty. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. And it should also be a new measure of how progressive the new leadership, the new superintendent, and some of the people that he's brought in will be, because a lot of his selling point in the first place was that he would be more sensitive to minority concerns, to parent concerns, and so forth. And this speaks to all of that.
So you think that'll come up next year, as in 2014, or next school season and end of 2013?
I believe the renewal is over the summer.
Okay. All right, moving on. The legislature kicks in this next week.
Yeah, state legislature reconvenes in Olympia on Monday, and it's going to be very interesting and very chaotic and a little bit scary this year. As we've talked about a little bit on the show before, the Republicans now control the state Senate, thanks to the defection of two Democrats, Senator Rodney Tom from the east side, and then Senator Tim Sheldon from Mason County. Rodney Tom, in exchange for his betrayal, has been named the Senate Majority Leader. But the real damage to this is going to be at the committee level, where you have very extreme radical Republicans in a lot of cases being chairs of the various committees in the Senate that will be considering bills, so that you have in many cases no chance to even get hearings held on bills, much less getting them up for a vote in the Senate, much less getting them passed. This is going to be a real concern around the budget. Because, of course, as we saw last year, when Republicans managed to hijack the budget process in the Senate, they produced a budget that looked very different than what the House, the Democrat-controlled House, produced, and those have to be reconciled and passed by new Governor Jay Inslee. But above and beyond that, you know, there are a whole laundry list of issues beyond the budget that it would be very helpful to see the state address, different types of revenue, regulatory things, you know, trying to fix the mess around that was left by the marijuana legalization initiative around the DUI requirements, a lot of different things that will be up for discussion in the state legislature this year. They have a 90-day session. Chances are very good all you're going to see passed are the things that are legally required to pass. This is pretty similar to what's happened in the U.S. Congress with the Republican Party over the last 10 years, certainly the last 4 years that Obama's been in office. And, you know, it also really provides a window to how much in denial about the nature of the modern Republican Party, both nationally and in this state, our local media is. I mean, you have more people, you know, making peons to the Republicanism of Dan Evans than you do an acknowledgement that the Republican delegation in Olympia, although it does have some people who are grounded and operate in the same universe as the rest of us, it has a number of them who don't. You now have Senator Pam Roach as part of the majority. You have Val Stevens as part of the majority, and a number of folks from Eastern Washington that are similarly, shall we say, reality challenged or differently realityed or something like that. So you have that. You have a progressive new governor who's going to have to get a lot of his appointments confirmed. That's going to be an issue potentially as well. So it's going to be a difficult session, and particularly given that Senate is not likely to sign off on any revenue increases. You're going to see once again a lot of attempts to attack really vital state social safety net programs, and for folks who want and need to advocate for those, hit the ground running. There will be a number of lobby days over the course of the legislative session. Get down to Olympia, meet with their legislatures, and particularly on the Democratic side, pressure them to hold firm. And they still have the governor's house, they still have the House of Representatives. They should have a majority. The Democrats technically do have a majority in the Senate, but having that held hostage to two Democrats who decided to caucus with the Republicans shouldn't bring the entire state government to a state of paralysis the way it has at the federal level.
And held hostage by lobbyists who every day is lobby day for them.
Yes, very much so. And what I've found in the times that I've been down there is a lot of times the legislators are really happy to hear from ordinary citizens, because they get, Olympia's a small town, and they get besieged by the same lobbyists all the time. Mm-hmm. And they know that those lobbyists' opinions are bought and paid for. They're not necessarily representative of the people who actually elect them. So go down there. You'll probably get a pretty good reception, and it's a very interesting process.
All right. Moving on locally, the Seattle mayor position has got a couple more hats in the ring this week.
Yeah, this had been widely expected, and he'd already informally signaled it, but Mayor Mike McGinn announced his re-election campaign this week. Occasion for a number of somewhat snarky stories covering it. But McGinn still does have a base. He still is the incumbent mayor. And even though he's been attacked from the left and from the right, particularly from the right, where, Tim Burgess and the Seattle Times has been trying to get him replaced, along with much of the downtown business community, ever since he got elected. But also he's disappointed a lot of people who originally got him elected in 2009, with some of his, particularly his defense of SPD abuses and some of his things that have been of concern to his environmental base as well. And then Omari Tahir Garrett, a blast from the past, has also announced this week. People may remember him getting into trouble in 2001 for physically attacking Mayor Paul Schell when Schell was running for re-election, and Tahir Garrett was running for that post as well. He often has good things to say. He often has things to say that are, shall we say, somewhat out of left field. But it will make the race more interesting, that's for sure.
All right. And then finally on local, Seattle Weekly, one of your old haunts.
Yeah, I'm not objectively exactly a neutral observer on this, but it is a major local media story, the Seattle Weekly, which people may remember is still published. It went out of business in 2006. No, that's when I left, but that's when the current controlling interest in Village Voice Media took over Seattle Weekly. It was actually originally New Times, an outfit out of Phoenix, and they really transformed the weekly into a publication that, both from the standpoint of political coverage and from the standpoint of music and movie cultural coverage, really has become pretty irrelevant over the last several years. For people who may be new to Seattle or whose memories may not go back this far, the Seattle Weekly predated The Stranger, was actually the dominant alternative weekly in town for a number of years. And The Stranger came along and has slowly supplanted them. And then, the various efforts to respond to The Stranger, have, eventually resulted in the papers being sold several times in the end of Village Voice Media. And for the last several years, it's been run by people who frankly haven't done a very good job. And so the paper has been sold again, this time to a local owner. Sound Publishing actually is not locally controlled. It's controlled by a Canadian named Donald Black, who owns a whole lot of media companies. But this particular company, Sound Publishing, owns the Little Nickel, owns a number of community papers in Washington State and Oregon. And it could really go any way with that. They could wind up trying to turn it into a newspaper that has actual alternative political coverage again, or they could turn it into the Little Nickel with more ads. But we'll see. But you know, the contempt with which, and I have to tread fairly carefully here because I don't want to betray any personal confidences or personal experiences, but the folks who have been running the weekly for the last 6 or 7 years have not done so with a whole lot of respect for their readership or their constituencies, and I don't think there are a lot of people in the local media scene who are sorry to see them go.
All right. Moving on to national, starting with President Obama signing an amendment this week.
Yeah, and give credit where credit is due. We're often very critical of our local politicians, but this is a Patty Murray brainchild, and she got it tacked on to legislation, and that legislation is signed by President Obama this week, creating a new suicide prevention program for active military personnel. This is something, where there have been record numbers of suicides, both of active military and of veterans, in recent years, with all the multiple deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, and head traumas and record PTSD rates and so forth, as well as a bad economy. There's been a huge epidemic of suicides in active military, and the military has been in many ways pretty reluctant to address mental health issues in general among active duty personnel, including sending them back to active duty and frontline duty when they shouldn't be. That creates that new program. It also expands VA mental health treatment eligibilities to family members of active duty personnel, and that too is going to be a huge step forward. So big props and credits to Patty Murray on that one.
All right. Bank of America in the news this week?
Yeah, Fannie Mae settling with Bank of America, and they had a $1.4 billion settlement last year with Bank of America for various liabilities going back to BOA's acquisition of Countrywide Financial in 2008. But Fannie Mae settling with Bank of America for all of their outstanding civil liabilities for over $12 billion stemming from toxic debt home deals from 2000 to 2008, that again being mortgage fraud committed by Countrywide Financial. Now, $12 billion sounds like a whole lot of money, but in this context, it's... It really is a slap on the wrist. The federal government has spent over $140 billion, that's 12 times the amount of BOA's settlement, to bail out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, owing to the damages that in large part resulted from the collapse caused by it's dealing with Countrywide Financial. So what Fannie Mae had been allegating was that Countrywide knowingly sold them defective and toxic products, and Fannie Mae then took on the debt, and this caused them to tank. So $140 billion to rescue that. And of course, at the same time, the federal government has also spent billions and billions, really going into trillions of dollars through TARP and other programs to subsidize BOA and other banks because of their damages due to their own practices. So a slap on the wrist for Bank of America once again. Bank of America still getting indirect bailouts from the federal government, as Elizabeth Warren has continued to point out in a number of other arenas, and there are still no laws on the books that prevent BOA and other banks from continuing with these same practices. And in fact, Maria was talking just last week that subprime loans continue to be given out like candy by a lot of these banks.
We have a speaker on tomorrow who calls it that we're living in a banktocracy. So
Yeah, that's about right.
Moving on, it looks like, at least in terms of a nomination, Obama has a new CIA person in mind.
Yeah. This on Monday, Obama formally announced the nomination of John Brennan as his choice for his second term CIA director. And this has got a lot of people worked up. People may remember, and they mentioned it also on Counterspin at the beginning of the program last half hour, that Brennan was originally Obama's choice to run the CIA in 2008 for his first term. That nomination was withdrawn over the controversy around Brennan's advocacy of torture during the Bush administration, when he had a top job in the Bush administration as well. And you know, the fact that that was intensely controversial then, but isn't expected to be a major barrier to his nomination right now, is really a telling example. And by the way, when Obama withdrew him as a CIA director, he appointed him as his top counterterrorism advisor again, which was lower profile, but in many ways just as bad, enabled Brennan to continue with exactly the same regimes. And it showed how committed Obama was to the same kind of abuses that happened under Bush. Brennan, for example, oversaw the Yemen program of signature strikes that included killing U.S. citizens. So, you know, Brennan isn't any more committed to human rights now than he was under Bush. And the lesson to that, really, is that, you know, in 2008, when Obama nominated Brennan, it was seen as, well, you know, Brennan could be a terrible influence on the Obama administration policy. I think now we've seen that it's really a reversal of a cause and effect, that Brennan is a symptom of Obama's abuses, not a cause of Obama's abuses. But the real takeaway from this is that the lack of congressional controversy this time around, it shows just how mainstream and bipartisan the Obama embrace of Bush's abuses have made U.S. human rights abuses. And for that matter, the same thing is true for a lot of the civil liberty abuses that have happened under the Obama administration. It's not just that there was a failure to prosecute the crimes of the Bush era, but this commission of the same crimes, or in some cases worse crimes, under Obama. And we talked about this at the time when these things were happening under George W. Bush, that the real danger of this went far beyond the immediate damage. It was also that it set a precedent. And now that the precedent has been set, it's been embraced by the other party. And because both parties now have a stake in defending their own behavior, it's become a fait accompli. And it's only left to those of us on the outside of the two-party system, or people within the two-party system who have the integrity to criticize their own allies, that it can become an issue. So it's very, very problematic. But at this point, it's not Brennan who's the issue. It's Obama.
All right. Moving on to a new study comparing healthcare.
Yeah, a study by the National Research Council and the Institute of Medicine, U.S. Health in the International Perspective, Shorter Lives and Poorer Health. And, of course, this is yet another study that has compared the U.S. healthcare system to that of other Western countries, Canada, Japan, Western Europe, and so forth, and found that U.S. outcomes are not nearly as good. In fact, among those countries, the U.S. was in last or close to last places in 9 key benchmark areas, those including infant mortality and low birth weight, injuries and homicides, teenage pregnancies and sexually transmitted infections, prevalence of HIV and AIDS, drug-related deaths, obesity and diabetes, heart disease, chronic lung disease, and disabilities. But the usual defense of the U.S. system is, well, we have excellent health care available. The technology is all there. It's just that it's not affordable for a lot of people. But what this makes this study unique is it found out that if you compare across cohorts in different countries, that even among the wealthy from country to country, the U.S. finishes last. Even among people who are covered by health insurance, the U.S. finishes last. So it's not just that the U.S. Healthcare system is obscenely expensive and unaffordable to a lot of people, or people can't get the kind of treatment or preventative care that they would for financial reasons. It's that the healthcare itself is also not good, and the public health practices themselves are not good. So that was very troubling. And we saw a very good example of that also come out this week with the CDC announcing that flu deaths this year have moved into the epidemic levels. The reasons for that they list are the relative ineffectiveness of this year's flu vaccine and the shortage of vaccines itself. And of course, both of those are specifically because the vaccine is provided by private big pharma drug companies who don't have real incentives to do the most effective thing. A lot of doctors and researchers have called, for example, for a new permanent vaccines that would give lifelong protection against all flu strains instead of doing partial protection each year against a mix and match set. You know, you would just get one flu shot, like getting a shot for measles or something else, and it would cover you, and you wouldn't have to go back every year. And, you know, but of course, it's more profitable to give flu shots every year. It's more profitable to not cover all strains because that's less expensive. And so no company wants to research making that type of vaccine or to actually produce it. So that's why we have epidemic levels of influenza this year.
All right. Quickly, a couple new polls about Congress.
Yeah, a New York Times CBS poll showing 85% disapproval of Congress, down from only 82% before the fiscal cliff. And to give that number some context, public policy polling did on one-on-one comparisons to just see just how much Americans hate Congress. And so they for example, discovered that 67% of Americans prefer lice to Congress. Only 19% prefer Congress to lice. 56% prefer root canals to Congress. Only 31% prefer Congress to root canals. Similarly, 56% prefer used car salesmen. 39%, including presumably Rob McKenna, prefer Nickelback. 41% preserve Genghis Khan. 44% prefer Donald Trump. And 45% prefer cockroaches versus 43% preferring Congress to cockroaches. Apparently 12% consider them equivalent. So Congress held in very high esteem right now.
All right. And just
No word on sexually transmitted diseases.
A little over. Those numbers are still coming in. A little over a minute. Talk about the visit from Karzai.
Yeah. Afghan president and U.S. puppet Hamid Karzai was in Washington, D.C. in the White House this week visiting with Barack Obama. And they jointly announced yesterday an early American role change, not a drawdown. Obama's been under a lot of pressure from his allies and from Congress and obviously from the American people to start drawing down American troops sooner than the end of this year. Timetable that he has set. But he has said that the American, he and Karzai announced this today, that the American role, the role of the American military will change in the middle of the year from being active combat to being support for Afghans taking control of their own security. The Obama quote, starting this spring, our troops will have a different mission, training, advising, and assisting Afghan forces, and said he would seek recommendations from commanders on the ground to determine how many or if any troops would stay in the country after 2014. So this is Obama saying that his promise to get troops out of the combat role at the end of 2014, isn't necessarily he may leave active military in there after 2014, and they the role may or may not be defined. So kind of a mixed message there. Very definitely still leaving all his options open.
All right. Events.
Several of them this week. All Day Today is the final day of a conference on human trafficking at the UW Hub. Go and check that out. I believe that's already started. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow at 9 o'clock, you heard him at 7:30, Palestine Archbishop, Palestinian, rather, Archbishop Elias Chakour, is the Melkite Greek Catholic Archbishop of the Galilee region, will be talking at the University Temple United Methodist Church. He's one of the world's foremost advocates of nonviolence. Yeah. He'll also be preaching at the services at 10:30.
9 a.m.
Yeah, 9 a.m. is the discussion, and then 10:30 is the preaching. University Temple United Methodist Church at 45th and 13th Northeast, 15th Northeast in the U District. And then next weekend, but we're talking about it now because on Saturday you'll want to catch an early ferry. Saturday, Ground Zero will be having its annual MLK Day celebration, MLK Weekend celebration, protesting nuclear weapons at the Bangor Nuclear Sub Base in Kitsap County. That will be 9:30 on Saturday morning. They will be starting with workshops and then vigils and civil disobedience in the afternoon. So check that out at gzcenter.org for a complete schedule of events.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State's at www.eatthestate.org. There's a new article up on the legislative session. We have, of course, as we've been going over for the last several weeks, our overhyped and underreported stories of 2012, and your comments and contributions, as always, welcomed.